Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who?
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars episode 24. We are the audio fanzine for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. You know, we've got a very Star Wars heavy episode this time. Often these episodes are Doctor Who heavy. This time it's totally flipped on its head. We've got our review of Star Wars Rebels, the last few episodes, with John and Alan coming on board to do that, and I think you'll really love it. Andy has put together a Darth Vader number one comic review. Marvel Comics has, of course, released a Darth Vader series, and he's also put together a small piece on Darth Vader in general, where he speaks to members of the Who Wars team and some people from outside the Who Wars team, and that's really cool. And Kate returns with a review of Marvel's Star Wars number 2, so that's all very cool stuff. We do have Doctor Who stuff, though. We've got a Doctor Who comic review. We've got some a couple of good listener questions that came through our Facebook page relating to Doctor Who. And so Doctor Who is covered as well. Everything's cool. All right, and speaking of feedback from listeners, I mentioned Facebook a moment ago. I've got a couple of pieces relating to our most recent episode where I was talking about the over-commercialization, if you like, of Doctor Who. The first comes from a Twitter user, 50DW50. I think that relates to the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, that handle, and I think he's written into us before. But he says here, "Thanks for episode 23. I am a little older than you, and I adore all the Who merchandise." And you know what? I think that's great, and I do think there's probably Who merchandise for everyone out there. I mean, I look around this room, I have Who merchandise here. I've got, you know, little bits and pieces I collected in the 80s, but I also have a lot of novels and non-fiction reference books and things of that nature. I also have a lot of the Doctor Who Titans, the little plastic blind box figures that have been coming out en masse recently. They're about to do a Sherlock series of them as well. I think they're coming along quite well, those Titans figures. But I digress. I also got a message on Facebook from Doc Hoom of the Diddly Dum podcast. This is a longer message, and it runs, "Rob, I was interested in your critique of the Doctor Who musical spectacular Murray Gold and the commercialization of the show, not least because I was thinking, what's this? The host of Who Wars turning all grumpy? Get your tanks off my lawn, Irwin." "The feeling that extreme commercialism is alien to Doctor Who but not Star Wars is, as you say, probably because there's always been the case for Star Wars but never used to be the case for Doctor Who. I think there's a danger in new Doctor Who being treated as a blockbuster and relentlessly pushed as a cash cow for the BBC. Doctor Who is not Star Wars. Not just because of its budget, etc., but because of its whole ethos. Doctor Who, at its best, has been about big themes treated in a small way. High concept delivered in the script and the acting, not in the visuals. Doctor Who isn't about huge space fleets, vast armies of aliens, and enormous explosions. My concern about the rumours of the Doctor Who movie, which keep cropping up, are that they'll concentrate on spectacular effects and the large scale to attract cinema audiences and to justify the budget, and that this will draw the focus away from the little nuanced details which have always allowed Doctor Who to punch above its weight. As for the, quotation marks, musical spectacular, while many of the Murray Gold compositions for Doctor Who are top draw, much of the stuff they play at the concerts and at the proms consists of turning up the volume to full blast to disguise very ordinary music. All the best, Doc Hoom." Thanks so much for that, Doc, and I do actually want to get Doc on the show in episodes ahead and maybe just have a segment where he and I chew the fat on issues, because I do think in many ways we are two grumpy older guys who have different views to people out there, and I think that's what people tune into podcasts to listen to, you know, to hear someone with a different view and to want to write in and contest that view is something people I think might enjoy, and I think that's what Doc Hume and I will deliver if we sit down and get going on some of these topics relating to Star Wars and Doctor Who. But stay tuned for that. We haven't got together yet, but I'd really, really like to do that. Doc Hume, I've loved him on the Diddly Dum podcast, and I'd love to have him guesting on Who Wars from time to time. All right, to finish up this week, another little Doctor Who snippet. 10th Planet Events are a group who get actors from Doctor Who together, usually from the classic era, and do little signings with them, usually for about, you know, £10 a pop, which is the usual price for an autographed photo at conventions and whatnot these days. And I've dealt with them many times over the years. I've got some wonderful autographs from them, including, you know, the likes of Nicholas Courtney, who's now no longer with us on this mortal plane. And I've had really good experiences with them. They have a signing coming up on the 28th, I believe, of this month, so a few days after this podcast goes out, where they have some classic era Doctor Who companions, such as William Russell and Peter Purvis, for example. And for me in particular, William Russell is, well, he's the original male companion on Doctor Who. He's also a companion I've greatly enjoyed when I was growing up and reading a lot of First Doctor novels. And he was going to come out to Australia a year or two ago, I think, and couldn't come due to ill health. I mean, when actors get older, I think of Christopher Lee, for example, in The Hobbit. He couldn't travel out to New Zealand to film his bits for The Hobbit. It does become very hard to travel, and I'm not sure William Russell will be coming to Australia in the future, so I'm certainly popping down my £10 to get a William Russell autograph at this next signing. And if you are interested in classic era Doctor Who autographs, not just William Russell, but as I mentioned, Peter Purvis and others are at this event, and they do events all through the year where they get interesting companions in to sign photos and whatnot. Do look them up. 10th Planet Events, you'll be able to Google it and find them. In fact, now that I think about it, over the years there have been a few autographs I should have got through 10th Planet, and now the people involved are sadly no longer with us, like Nicholas Courtney. And I feel that it's an opportunity lost sometimes when you sit back and think, oh yeah, I'll get that autograph, you know, next year or the year after. It doesn't always work that way with people, and not even necessarily with older actors. Sometimes, you know, even younger actors who have been on the series have unfortunately passed away well before their time. And if you would like a little memento of them and a signed photo of them, do look up 10th Planet Events and see what they've got. Alrighty, moving on to the Star Wars and Doctor Who stories of the week. Let's get into it. Okay, and moving into our Star Wars and Doctor Who stories of the week, let's start with Star Wars, as we normally do. There is a... well, this is a bit of a non-story, actually, because I'm not going to give you any specifics, but there is a big, big rumour out there this week about Star Wars Episode 7, which is entirely plausible, and if true, could be absolutely huge. Now, what I can say is it's nothing that Star Wars fans haven't already speculated on before, and I think given that Star Wars fans have speculated on 1,001 different things, I don't think that's really a clue. What I will say is if you go Googling, you know, Star Wars spoiler, this could come up straight away. Some of the articles almost give the game away in their headlines. And it's only out there if you really, really want to know it, because if true, it could change Star Wars as we know it. And I think that's all I can say about that. Related to that, though, J.J. Abrams was recently hosting the Irish Oscar Wilde Awards in Los Angeles. Now, these are an awards I've never heard of. They sound a bit strange. I guess they're for, you know, fifth or sixth generation Americans who still think of themselves as Irish for some reason. I've never really understood that, particularly coming from a Scots-Irish background myself, but I digress. Carrie Fisher was there being honoured. I didn't know Carrie Fisher had any Irish in her at all, but she was there getting an award. That's why J.J. Abrams was there, I believe, and some reporters got to him and said, you know, what about the secrecy surrounding the Episode 7 script? To which Abrams said, we did the best we can to preserve the story for the audience, but it doesn't always work. There are a ton of rumours, some true, some false. But I'm grateful to everyone who would want to read a spoiler because it means they care and want to see the movie. I know what it feels like as an enormous Star Wars fan myself. So there you go, J.J. Abrams just being awesome as always. And I think it's a real shame that he's only directing the first of the three films. I think it might have been nice to see him do all three. That's just a random thought out of nowhere. Anyway, let's move on. Taron Egerton, no relation to Joel Egerton, who of course was Uncle Owen in a couple of the prequels. He's a 25-year-old Welsh actor who you might not have ever heard of before. He's currently the breakout star of Kingsman: The Secret Service. Anyway, Taron Egerton is currently being bandied around as a possible young Han Solo in one of the upcoming standalone Star Wars films. Now, we've heard many examples of potential young Han Solos for this film, so treat this with a grain of salt. It could be true, it might not be true. It could just be that, you know, Taron Egerton is on the minds of gossip columnists at the moment, and he's young, male, and has short brown hair. So of course he's going to be Han Solo. You know, of course he will be. He has all the criteria. I'm being facetious. Let's move on. This is an interesting story. It's a very Australia, actually Sydney-based story. Star Wars producer Rick McCallum is selling his Sydney apartment. It's in Darling Point. It's in Sydney's eastern suburbs, which is quite an affluent area, I've got to say, of Sydney. And to be quite honest with you, I didn't know that Rick McCallum was living here. Apparently, he's off to live in the Czech Republic, which is a wonderful place to go and live. Very historical, very beautiful. But, yeah, he's been living at least some of the year in this Darling Point apartment here in Sydney. I had no clue, and this is my hometown, so he's been fairly low profile, it seems. I could have bumped into him at a local coffee shop or, you know, at some sporting event or something. Who knows? And if you want to see Rick's pad, throw in Rick McCallum, Darling Point. I'm sure you'll find the article. It's a beautiful, beautiful home. Beautiful views, beautiful interior. If you've got a spare $6.5 million, you can purchase it. Sydney property is just outrageous, but well worth the money if you do have it, because, yeah, look, if you see the pictures, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And that's the Star Wars news for this week. Let's move on with some Doctor Who news. And the main thing I'll talk about this time around is a Radio Times article that recently got updated, which is everything we know about Doctor Who Series 9, because I guess this is what's on most Doctor Who fans' minds at the moment. Now, we now know that the first two episodes of this season will be a two-parter called The Magician's Apprentice and The Witch's Familiar. We've already talked about the title The Magician's Apprentice before, but The Witch's Familiar is new. That's very cool. And they'll both be directed by Hetty MacDonald, who directed Blink, which of course is one of the great Doctor Who episodes of the modern era, and Stephen Moffat is on writing duties for both episodes. Now, we also got a picture from the set, an official picture at least. There's a lot of spy pictures out there, and this shows a control room of some kind with a map of the world and a lot of red dots all over North America and some over Europe, and it looks like some elsewhere too. Some are over oceans. So what this shows, I guess, is some kind of invasion, some kind of outbreak. I guess with some of the dots over the oceans, it's a threat that could be airborne in nature. I'm not sure. As always with teaser images like this, it's just very, very intriguing. Moving on, it's been officially confirmed that Missy, or the Master, will return in the opening two-parter of Series 9, and I guess this isn't being treated like a spoiler by anyone, least of all the BBC. Everyone's out there talking about it. Stephen Moffat has said, "Everyone hide. Michelle Gomez's Missy was an instant hit last year, so she's straight back to plague the Doctor and Clara in the series opener, but what brings her back into their lives is the last thing they'd expect." So, what does that mean? I don't know. Anyway, Missy, I've said at the end of last series, even though I was disappointed with the two stories in the finale of last year, I thought Missy deserved to come back, and here she is. She's back straight away. It's quite amazing, actually, how quickly she's come back. In some ways, though, it does negate the story of the Brigadier, or the Cyberbrig, or the Iron Patriot, or whatever you want to call him after he became a Cyberman, because it seemed that his last act on Earth was to kill the Doctor's archenemy, the Master, or Missy. And at the time I said, look, I don't think they'd kill off the Master like that, and I'd like to see Michelle Gomez back. And besides, the ray that got used didn't look quite right either. So, yeah, it's a weird one. It's good to see Missy come back. It does negate the way the Brigadier ended last season. It's all a bit of a mess. I don't think the Brigadier should have came back as the Cyber Brig at all myself. I think he should have just been left to have the farewell he'd already had in Doctor Who. We didn't really need to push that button But I digress. Enough podcasts and enough articles have been written about that topic for you to know probably how I feel about that. Kate Lethbridge-Stewart, played by Gemma Redgrave, will be back in this opening part, two-parter as well. Obviously, she'll be there to help the Doctor fight the Master. Gemma Redgrave is an awesome actor, and you know what? I'd like to see Kate Lethbridge-Stewart be the Doctor's companion for Series 9 rather than Clara. I think in the Christmas special, we got to say goodbye to Clara properly. Her and the Doctor resolved everything. We saw that she'd had a great life without him. It was time to move on at that point. And I think, this has been said before, so it's nothing profound, I think an older actress like Gemma Redgrave would play off well with an older Doctor like Peter Capaldi. And I would just kill to see Kate Lethbridge-Stewart as the companion this series. You already know my thoughts as well on companions in general. I think they should last about a series each, and each Doctor should get, you know, three or four companions over their time on the show, so we see different emotions and different characteristics brought out of the Doctor by different companions. Blah, 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 blah. You know my thoughts on this. So, yeah, seeing Kate come back like this, it just reminds me how much I'd like to see perhaps an older companion, and definitely a different companion for this series rather than Jenna Coleman. No disrespect to Jenna, I just would like to see companions change more often. Other guest stars in these episodes include Kelly Hunter, who some might recognise as being part of the Sisterhood of Khan in the Little Paul McGann mini-episode, The Night of the Doctor. And what else have we got here? Filming began on January the 5th, so they've been filming for, what, about a month and 17 days at this point in time. They'll already have a lot of footage under their belt. The episodes being filmed first are a two-parter being written by Toby Whithouse. Now, people might remember Toby Whithouse for writing School Reunion, Vampires of Venice, The God Complex, and A Town Called Mercy. Out of those stories, I thought School Reunion was great, and I thought The God Complex was great. Not so keen on Vampires of Venice or A Town Called Mercy, so he's got a 50-50 hit rate with me at the moment. It's up to him now with his fifth story to see what he can produce. We were mentioning guest stars a moment ago. I was remiss to mention that Game of Thrones' Paul Kay is also going to pop up in these two episodes. So if you're a Game of Thrones fan, you'll know exactly who Paul Kay is. The article then rolls into some older stuff, which we already know, such as Jenna Coleman is staying for all of Series 9, and that the 12th Doctor will develop further. There's an interesting quote from Peter Capaldi saying, "I think you have to keep moving. If he's regenerated, he's learning about himself and how he responds to the universe, so he probably will be different again when he comes back. We're still pushing to find out who this character is. There are more mysteries about him." So that's good. I'd like to see the Doctor explore himself a bit further. I think we got flashes of that in the episode Listen in the past series, where he was talking to himself at the start of that episode, and we were sort of getting an insight into his mind and how he thinks. There have been other scenes as well which I think have hinted at this Doctor's personality. I think back to Deep Breath, where he's got that glass of whiskey and he offers it to the half-faced man and says, you know, "I thought you might like a drink because I think I have to kill you," or whatever that exact line was. A very interesting Doctor, and I think he's going to unfold. To me, the only thing that needs adding is a new companion, but I just went on about that enough, so I'll shut up now. Unrelated to this article, but related to the filming of Series 9, is I've seen a Spy report recently mentioning some scenes set around Coal Hill School. I've got to say, at which point I just put my head in my hands and thought, why are we going back to Coal Hill School? I thought Series 8 was the arc where we had Danny Pink and Clara as teachers at the school, and we had a lot of episodes set around the school. It became sort of a, well, not a base, but sort of a starting off point for several episodes. And I thought this series, well, I thought we'd get rid of Clara for a start, but again, putting that aside, I thought we'd, you know, maybe have more episodes out in space, back in time, perhaps not so much set around Coal Hill School. Maybe I'm overreacting, maybe it's only one episode this series that's set at the school, but just the fact that we're going back there at all, I'm not so sure about. I think that sort of theme has played itself out. I don't think we need to go back there, but we are. This could be an interesting series. Moving on and to round out the Who news this week, I did see an interesting article, again an Australian-based one, like the Rick McCallum selling his apartment story, and it revolves around a man called Leslie Craythorne, because when he retires, as the Melbourne Conservatorium's senior technical officer later this year, he's going to leave behind a rare instrument. You see, on the request of the university, Mr. Craythorne has spent some of the last months of his time on the job restoring a rare Electronic Music Studios, or EMS, Synthy 100 modular synthesizer. Now, if you look up this story, if you chuck in Mr. Craythorne and, you know, EMS Synthy 100, I'm sure you'll find this article pretty easily. It's an old synthesizer. It's absolutely massive. It takes up a wall, and there's knobs and dials and buttons and all sorts of stuff. And it is exactly the same instrument that was used by the BBC Radiophonic Workshop in the 1970s to create the sound effects and sometimes the incidental music for Doctor Who. If you think of the Pertwee episodes and some of the Tom Baker episodes, you know, those weird electronic sounds in the background, they were made by this kind of instrument. So down at the Melbourne Conservatorium of Music, they have one. It's completely restored. And for people interested in the music of Doctor Who, or even just music in general, particularly synth music, it's well worth a look. It's a very, very cool thing. And that wraps it up for the Star Wars and Doctor Who news this episode. Now, before we move on to the Rebels Roundup, which is the first submission from Alan and John on Star Wars Rebels, the AM Audio Media people, great friends of the show, have put together a little promo bumper for Who Wars. They've put a bit of thought into it. They've acted out a little scene, and I'll play it now. I think it's very cute. I hope you like it too.
Yo, man, you know what we should do?
Yeah, what's that, man?
We should come up with, like, this really amazing combination between Star Wars and Doctor Who and, like, put them together.
Shoot, you just blew my mind, bro.
Yeah, I blew my own,
too. We need that. We need that kind of website.
Yeah, we
do. Doctor Who. What should we call it?
I don't know. How about, like, Star Doctor or something?
No. How about, like, the Doctor and Yoda?
No, I don't like... No. That was Skywalker Who or...
No. How about, like, Jabba the Doctor?
Jabba... Yeah, well, what about Stormtrooper?
Excuse me, gentlemen, excuse me. Can I help you with something? I am the...
No, we're good.
I'm the Dark Journey Doctor. I'll be the judge of whether you're good or not.
Shoot. Oh,
and
wow,
this is
really?
Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes.
Good day, gentlemen.
Oh, my God.
Elementary, you might say.
Something in the air.
I believe I can clarify things. Holmes, do you think we can clarify things?
Yes, we can clarify
things. I think you should entitle it whowars.net. And I think people should go
and
check it out.
That's inspiring, Doctor. Inspiring.
You guys, you're not the doctor for nothing. That's
there you
true.
Go.
Yeah,
consider yourself genius.
I smell herbs.
Check out whowars.net for all the most exciting news on Star Wars and Doctor Who. Travel into the vortex, but remember, take a lightsaber.
Hey there, everyone. It's Rob here. Look, I'm sure you want to get on to John and Alan talking about Star Wars Rebels and not hear me, you know, rabbit on. I've already spoken enough in this episode, but I just thought I'd jump in here at the start of their very first contribution to Who Wars to say how happy I am to have two new team members on and have two team members looking after Star Wars Rebels. It's definitely in good hands. I've obviously listened to this piece from them already, and I'm really looking forward to what they bring us in the weeks and months ahead. So, guys, take it away.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to Rebels Roundup. I'm Alan Zog alongside John Williams, and we're here to talk about Star Wars Rebels. We are excited about this new opportunity, Rob, to be a part of the Who Wars and to talk about Rebels. John, I'm way excited. I know you are.
Yeah, definitely. This is one of my favorite subjects to talk about these days, it seems like.
All right. Well, why don't we jump right into it? We talked about wanting to talk a little about We're going to talk about Call to Action, which is the most recent episode from last week, but we want to go one episode before that, just get everybody caught up to date a little bit. All right, so we're talking about Vision of Hope. The episode featured Travis, who early on in the series is a senator who is leading the rebel cause, or at least it would seem that way. What did you think of that episode, John?
It's really interesting because it's surrounded by so many good episodes. I didn't actually find it as good as the other ones around it. Like, the first two just before it, because you had Path of the Jedi, and then you had Idiot's Array. And Path of the Jedi was an amazing episode, and Idiot's Array was really good. And so I had a lot of hope for Vision of Hope, but it was a little slower than I thought it would be. And I still within it, there were some really great things about it. And I thought Brent Spiner, who played Travis, did a really good job of portraying the character, but it just wasn't as gripping in some respects as the episode after it and before it had been, to my mind. I don't know. What did you think?
I agree. It almost seemed like a letdown. What I will say is I think it sets up nicely the next episode, Call to Action. I really do think it sets it up quite nicely. And really, so did the previous episode. We see in two instances where, you know, the Inquisitor in the previous episode lost Ezra and Kanan. They got away from him. And he said, you know, my master will not be pleased. Then we go into this one with Travis and the Imperial, the group trying to chase them down end up failing and letting them go. And it kind of sets up our Call to Action episode. The one thing I did like about it, though, and I'm finding this out, this is what I've liked about this series, is it's been very dark because you're starting to see in the dark times of the Empire that they will do just about anything to destroy the of those around. Whether it's rebels rising, Jedi rising, whatever it might be, they're going to do everything they can to destroy any part of hope that could exist.
Yes, and that was definitely made clear in Call to Action. In fact, that was, I think, one of the strongest moments in all of it, in all of that episode was with Tarkin, who's played by Stephen Stanton, and his great grasp of the character and a great grasp of the voice, too. Like, I thought he was so much like Governor Tarkin from the first Star Wars movie that you could close your eyes and almost see this, you know, the Peter Cushing character.
Yep.
But when he's there and he's talking about the Jedi and talking about, regardless of whether that Jedi's a real Jedi, he becomes a center point for the hope of everyone who doesn't want the Empire to succeed. I think that was an amazing addition. And I thought it pinned down exactly why they were hunting and killing them all. It was excellent. It's amazing to me to see this series, and I'm always, I have to say, surprised when I'm talking to people and they say they haven't watched any of it, because I sit there and I think, you're missing so many good things in this series and so many things that are very important to the whole story of Star Wars. And in a way, much like, especially the later half of, the Clone Wars, because I thought the last half of Clone Wars, especially the Netflix released season where they went into Order 66 and then went on into Force Ghosts and How You Become One, really added to the canon and added to the overall understanding we have of Star Wars that we just didn't get through the movies. And so I feel like that's the same way here. We're missing stuff when we don't watch these episodes, in my opinion. So I just love them.
I agree. Well, and, you know, it's funny, leading up to our podcast tonight, I took some time to go back to Clone Wars. I went back to season 3, started watching a couple of episodes from season 3, because that's when Tarkin is introduced in the Clone Wars series. We see him in episode 3, but in the tail end, he doesn't say anything, but you see that he's overseeing the process of the building of the Death Star. But in the Clone Wars, he appears. And he is involved with the Jedi. He works with the Jedi. He is, you know, he's one of the rebel, the Republic's, leaders that is working with the Jedi to try and fight against the separatists. And you learn a little bit about him back then. And then it leads us right into this episode, Call to Action, where now he's very familiar with the Jedi. He makes that very clear in this episode. I know who the Jedi are. I've worked with the Jedi. I've been around the Jedi. And he emphasizes that so well. And it's kind of nice to see all those backstories come together.
Yeah, absolutely. I really love the fact that he rips them to pieces as being, you know, they're ancient, they're old news, they're so old. And then you start to think about it and realize this is only 15 years after that incident that wiped them out. So really, they're not that ancient, but yet he makes that clear that they're long gone. They're almost like a myth. But then the other thing that was interesting is the fact that he then stresses who killed them and pushes that whole idea that if they were so great, you know, maybe they shouldn't have been wiped out so easily. And I really, really love the way this was set up, and I'm excited to see Rebel Resolve and then Fire Across the Galaxy, which is the concluding episode. I think those will be amazing episodes. I'm so excited. There's been, out of the entire series, I think there's been two where I haven't been uber excited at the end of watching them, but every other episode I've just been so pleased and so excited and so evangelical about the show to other people. Because it's just...
Ooh, evangelical. I like that word.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, I do proselyte for this particular series to a bunch of my podcast mates on another podcast, and I try and tell them, man, if you want to know what's going on in Star Wars, this is the best thing we've got right now, and it's excellent.
I would agree. I would totally agree. There was one other thing I enjoyed about Call to Action 2, and actually it's been this way through the whole series, but the one thing I really liked was the music. Mm. The entrance in the opening scene, you see, Tarkin appear, you know, flying in, much like we do in Empire, much like we did in Return of the Jedi when the Emperor arrives at the Death Star and he arrives in his shuttle. So Tarkin's the same way, and you get the Imperial March, Vader's theme, as the episode opens, and throughout the entire episode, you get ghosts of that theme, of the Imperial theme throughout the episode. This episode reminds me so much of, if I could call this episode one thing, this would be the Empire Strikes Back episode, because we've seen the Rebels, we've seen them get away with things all season long, we've seen them meddle in the Empire's business, we've seen them do so many things. And you've been been alongside them. They've been heroes. This is the one episode where the thematic feel for it is much like Empire. The Empire is retaking control right here. And you better watch out because they're in control and they want you to understand that they are.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think the other thing musically that really triggered it for me as I watched it through the second time was when the Inquisitor comes out. He has his own theme that comes out, which is very reminiscent, actually, of Duel of Fates.
Yes.
And, man, is it ever good. I don't, you know, they've done such a good job. I mean, even if you go back to Empire Day and they do the kind of celebratory version of the Imperial March, it's just amazing how they've taken the music that we know and they've tweaked it a bit and made it such an integral part of the series. In some ways, I think better than the Clone Wars did.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I have the soundtrack for the Clone Wars and been listening to it, and there's a lot of themes that I like throughout it, but I think this one is heavier on the themes than even Clone Wars was, for sure.
Yeah, and that may be because they're using the ones we're used to. But
what did you think of the scene when Tarkin basically was talking to the two guardsmen and the Inquisitor ended up taking their heads?
Well, this, to me, that scene was amazing, really well done, and you're given no doubt as to what happened to them. There's always been this sort of talk about, oh, once Disney puts this on a cartoon, it's never going to be the same as Clone Wars. Well, guess what?
It is.
It is. And they're not going to shy away from the dark parts of the Empire, and they shouldn't, because regardless of who this is aimed at, I mean, I was an 8-year-old when I saw the first Star Wars. And Darth Vader was a mean and nasty man through that entire series, or that entire movie. And yet, it thrilled me to see him, and he became a big star, effectively, because of that. So, you want your bad guys to be bad guys. You don't want them to be buffoons. I mean, that's the whole point that Dave Filoni made as to why Darth Vader is not the regular opposition in this episode. He doesn't want, or these series, is because he doesn't want him to be perceived as the buffoon who can't do it. And I think he's done the same thing with Tarkin, where he's brought him into the series, but right away he gets everything right, as opposed to the other guys who are getting it all wrong.
Right. Well, and he does a very good job of, again, bringing out Tarkin's arrogance, Tarkin's mistrust with really anybody. I mean, you go back to A New Hope, and you see Tarkin is in control of everything. Even Vader himself, who really we learn is in control of everything, even he steps back and lets Tarkin take control of everything through A New Hope. And we see that here. The Inquisitor is under the charge of Vader. We've learned that from the opening of the season. Inquisitor is employed and under, you know, employment by Vader. But you see him even defer to Tarkin in this episode and understand that Tarkin is the man. and nobody's going to get in his way.
Yeah. Now, have you read Tarkin the book?
I have not.
Okay. So if you read Tarkin, what it shows in that book, again, this is a canon book, it shows that the leadership of the Empire is almost like a triumvirate, much like the old Roman Republic, or even the Roman Empire, where there was a triumvirate of leaders at times, especially later in the Empire, where there was multiple emperors floating around, mm-hmm. sort of commanding the East and the West Empire, and sometimes they had, like, subordinate emperors as well. They could have up to four. Well, this is effectively what the point of Tarkin brought up, is that Tarkin and Vader are on an equal level to the Emperor. Even though Vader is the apprentice to him as the Sith, Tarkin is basically the second command of the military and the government. And so, realistically, without Tarkin, Vader can't work. And
right.
I think they do a very good job of pointing out the fact that Anakin was never very good politically. He could not handle politics. And Vader is no different than Anakin was. He's not a politician, so he doesn't have that acumen, and mm-hmm. so he's not expected to be that. That's what Tarkin is. Tarkin is the politician. He's the military leader. He's the guy that will get stuff done. Vader is sort of your iron fist that you send out to basically destroy things.
Which explains Empire even more, because now you see Tarkin is dead and Vader takes complete control, and it's an iron fist all throughout.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I think it does a really good job of showing the three characters and kind of what's expected of each of them, especially from the point of view of the Emperor's expectations for Tarkin and Vader to work together, which at that point, which was Tarkin's based 5 years after Revenge of the Sith. And so it, you know, time has passed, but there's still a little bit of distrust. There's just still a little bit of misunderstanding between the two. And in the book, they make it quite clear that Tarkin only suspects who's under the mask. He doesn't know. So, yeah. So it's really fascinating. And I think that's what I love about this, what they bring into this, is that they continue that dynamic of him being, you know, the third party in this empire who can come into a situation, take total control, and at no point raise his voice. I don't know if you noticed that either.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, he talked very calmly through the whole thing, even as he totally tore them to shreds.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes it quite clear right from the beginning when she gives him the, oh, we're so glad to have you. And he's like, I'm not glad to be here. And right. So he was not messing around, but never raised his voice, never ranted, never raved, played it almost identical to the way he was even in A New Hope, where I think the only time you hear him really raise his voice is when he got angry about her lying to them.
Right.
So, her being Princess Leia, of course, when she says they're on Dantooine and he gets mad about that. But it's one thing I've noticed with his character and definitely in the way that they played him in the series is he's very much the calm in a lot of storm. So.
No, and that's a good point. I didn't even think about that, but so, no, and back to it all, I mean, bring it full circle. They do a fantastic job here in Rebels of that, as well as just everything. I mean, I'm looking forward to future episodes with you because we get to talk about the season as a whole, Rebels as a whole, and really kind of go over things and revisit it all. I'm looking forward to that. Folks, if you're listening to us, this is going to be fun. Keep on listening because we're going to bring some wonderful topics about Rebels coming up in the future.
Absolutely. And let's hope that season two starts sooner than the fall.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Hello, hello, hello. Last month saw the publication of Marvel's flagship Star Wars title. A month later, and we have their first single character title with Darth Vader. To celebrate the release of this comic, I'm going to explore whether Darth Vader is more than just the off-the-peg bad guy in a movie, and has he got the potential to take the lead? Darth Vader, one of the most striking, recognizable cinematic creations ever.
The image of his mask alone strikes fear across the planets of the Star Wars universe and sends excitement through every Star Wars fan. But just who is the real Darth Vader?
In terms of Darth Vader as a character, I think the best way you could quickly sum him up is to say that he's a tragic hero. You know, Aristotle said a tragic hero ought to be a man whose misfortune comes to him not through vice or depravity, but by some error of judgment.
Honestly, I've never met the man, and it would be unfair of me to talk about him. I try not to be judgmental, especially seeing as this was all a long, long time ago, and history, it tends to be written by the victors.
To sum up his character in a sentence, I would say that Darth Vader only exists because everyone who should have been looking out for Anakin fumbled the ball.
When you first see Darth Vader, it's the personification of terror. He's just this merciless menace who doesn't hesitate to kill and force choke people, and he's just terrifying. But then you come to realize when you look beneath the surface that Anakin's life, ever since he was a little boy, he's seen suffering and he's experienced pain and loss. That gives us a really good background about who Anakin was and who he became.
Although the most recognizable baddie in the Star Wars saga, where does he actually sit in the hierarchy of the Empire? He has a superior, and let's face it, not a nice one, in the Emperor. And this whole Sith Force, Jedi, Rebel thing isn't actually that central to the day-to-day running of the Galactic Civil War in A New Hope. The Rebels have corrupted May the Force Be With You to nothing more than a day-to-day saying, in much the same way as we would say bless you when someone sneezes. Originally said in simpler times to cleanse you of the demonic spirits that had left your body, you know. The Jedi Order has become a bit of history, a bit of pop culture of the Outer Rim, a bit of a religious cult by the time of A New Hope.
Kid, I've flown from one side of this galaxy to the other. I've seen a lot of strange stuff, but I've never seen anything to make me believe there's one all-powerful force controlling everything. There's no mystical energy field controls my destiny. It's all a lot of simple tricks and nonsense.
Even Lord Vader himself is mocked and sneered at by senior Imperial officers.
Don't try to frighten us with your sorcerer's ways, Lord Vader. Your sad devotion to that ancient religion has not helped you conjure up the stolen data tapes, or given you clairvoyance enough to find the rebels' hidden fort.
So what exactly is Vader's job or position in the Empire?
I always kind of thought of him as a puppet to the Emperor. You really see that displayed, like, in episode 3 when he actually becomes Darth Vader. So I think he's, like, second in command to the Emperor, so I'm going to call him Vice Emperor. How's that? Is that a thing? Let's go with it.
Darth Vader's job title is probably something along the lines of Minister of Culture and Sport, because evil is often extremely banal and hides itself under that.
I didn't realise Vader actually had an official job title. I thought it was a work experience placement that just got a bit out of hand.
I think when it comes to a job title for Darth Vader, I can't go past a word like enforcer. I think enforcer really, you know, highlights what Vader is. He's not in charge of the Empire. He's the hired muscle. He's the guy you go and send to board ships like we see in episode 4, or go and rough up a civilian population, or even within the Empire itself, if something's not going to plan, you might send Vader over to lean on the Imperial commanders involved, maybe even Choker, one or two of them, for good measure.
As we all seem to agree, Vader is very much a vice president, deputy prime minister role. Sounds important, but only if the Emperor is really ill. Vader becomes a troubleshooter, an ambassador, overseeing things, and brainwashed by his master, being the eyes, ears, and mouth of the Emperor around the treacherous, bungling, or lazy soldiers and officers of the Empire. He's also the poster boy. The Emperor may control with fear, but Vader is the image of that fear. For all that he's evil, however, Vader is popular among fans the world over. But why do Star Wars fans identify with him and admire this striking character if he epitomises evil? Well, I've had a thought about how he's interpreted by UK fans, at least. Even before The Empire Strikes Back and its big reveal, I won't mention the spoilers in case you haven't seen that one, I think we saw him as a father figure. There's often talk about how his name in Dutch or German is a corruption of Dark Father, and here I put his huge following down to one man, the great Dave Prowse. In the 1970s and 80s, there wasn't the budget to attract the big Hollywood stars to guest on UK children's TV and chat shows, so the phone calls were directed to the agents of the British-based Star Wars actors, most notably Dave Prowse and Kenny Baker, who played R2-D2. Here's Dave himself in a 1980 edition of Kids Show Clapperboard, revealing a big factor in the love for Darth and Dave.
And of course you're the Green Cross Man, aren't you?
I'm the Green Cross
How
Man.
How tall that, are you? Back then?
Well, I'm 6'6 and I weigh about 19 stone. But the Green Cross Code and Darth Vader came at the same, almost exactly the same period. In fact, the Star Wars people gave me a week off to go and film the Green Cross Code commercials, and it's marvellous because the Darth Vader has given the Green Cross Code Man a lot of publicity.
It's double
it is, yes, because I'm the sort of the goodie on one side and the baddie on the other. And at one time the Department of Transport nearly sacked me because they thought my image as Darth Vader would have a detrimental effect on my image as the Green Cross Code Man.
That's right. Dressed in tight green and white lycra, Dave taught us road safety as the Green Cross Code Man. Interestingly, the road safety campaign that preceded Dave's was fronted by one John Pertwee. And because we like links, Dave Prowse also played the Minotaur in the Pertwee Doctor Who story, The Time Monster. Everything's connected. Dave's acting folio wasn't just Minotaurs, but also Frankenstein's Monster and a host of crooks and heavies. Dave got these parts through his 2-meter frame and his physique, acquired as a fitness trainer and a bodybuilder. His height and use of weights took its toll, however, and health problems have slowed Dave down in recent years. This led to some negative press speculation not so long ago, to which Dave had this to say.
I am rapidly approaching my 80th birthday. I am extremely busy running my business from home and fitting in all the requests for personal appearances in the UK and worldwide. I already have 32 shows lined up for this year. I'd like to refute an article in the Daily Mirror that gave the impression I'm suffering from dementia, have lost my memory, and am senile. What rubbish! I do admit to having a memory problem. I think it comes with age. I attend a memory clinic when I remember to go. Watch this space for progress reports when I remember to write them.
It's great to know Dave's still out there promoting Darth Vader at conventions and giving fans what they want. Perhaps one of the items of merchandise he'll be selling for you soon at a convention will be issue one of Darth Vader comic. But what of the character himself? Vader is a terrifying puppet of the Empire, feared by allies and enemies alike. But he has an anger built up inside based on emotions he doesn't understand. This is a complex character with clear cinematic bookends. We know how he begins, we know how he ends. Can Marvel bring something new to Darth Vader without diluting his character? There's only one way to find out. A big thank you to our contributors, writer and illustrator Al Noh, writer and podcaster Betsy Chevron, writer and performer Sean Wilson, and of course, from Who Wars, Kate and Rob.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
In Marvel's original run of Star Wars comics, Darth Vader would simply continue his on-screen job troubleshooting for the Empire on a variety of missions for the Emperor. Although exciting to see him, this could be tedious and repetitive, so just what can they do for Vader in the 21st century incarnation of the comic? Well, let me tell you, Marvel certainly had a serious and fruitful meeting when creating the Vader comic. The best way I can describe this comic is that they've created a HBO series with Vader as the central character. Yes, we still see Vader at his day job as the evil envoy for the Empire, but what's really interesting is the way they've decided to develop the character within his existing timeline. We get to see what he does and thinks in his downtime and in the moments between his tasks. Let's just say this guy is seriously mixed up and you truly feel sympathy for him. Writer Kieran Gillen has taken the conflicting aspects of Anakin from episode 3 that lead to his downfall and put them into the fully formed Vader. On the one hand, he's cool and collected. On the other, he's a raging psycho. We get this in our opening scenes. Like Star Wars comic issue 1, this one starts with something familiar. A dusty road leading to Jabba the Hutt's palace. The heavy palace door slowly opening. A lone cloaked figure confidently walks in, but is blocked by two Gamorrean pig guards. He ignites his red lightsaber and slices them to pieces. Why is Vader visiting the mighty Jabba? We learn he has an appointment with the vile gangster, but has arrived a day early. Jabba is not happy with the death of his guards and this early intrusion, and an exchange takes place. Vader wants a private audience without the scum and villainy of the throne room. Jabba mocks the Dark Lord and makes the mistake of calling him a Jedi. More carnage from the Dark Lord of the Sith. And Jabba and Vader are alone. Vader is early because he desires a personal favour. Now this is where some other clever bits come into play in this comic that give it that TV drama feel. Firstly, we get a flashback to the day before. Vader is reporting to the Emperor. We see a very interesting relationship here. Vader, a proud, focused member of the Empire, wanting to please his master like an obedient hound. And Palpatine, more obsessed with politics. Vader reports on what's happened in the first issue of the Star Wars comic, with his failed mission to meet with Jabba's envoy on Simoon. The Emperor has more to discuss. This is where our next element comes in, which you might not expect in this title. Humour. The opening scroll sets up the chronology of the story with this belter of a line. The Emperor's ultimate peacekeeping force, the Death Star, was destroyed due to an unforeseen design flaw. Now this perhaps wrong-foots you, as if this comic is going to be a parody of itself, but it's the very destruction of the Death Star that gives us an insight into a working relationship between master and apprentice, where you just want to give Vader a hug. As the sole survivor of the Empire elite in charge of the Death Star, after Motti and Tarkin are destroyed in the final assault, the Emperor has decided to punish Vader and hold him responsible for the loss of their most powerful deterrent. Some more humour here, with Vader trying to get in his line about the Death Star being nothing compared to the Force, but is interrupted by Palpatine. Vader is to be punished by not being given command of the Imperial forces. This honour will go to another of the Imperial elite from A New Hope, General Targ, and Vader will obey his command. Vader is told he must meet with Jabba the Hutt to arrange an Imperial presence or link in the Outer Rim. Vader has a great line here.
I am not accustomed to haggling.
This scene ends with the Emperor meeting his next appointment, an Empire agent. He decides to keep his identity secret from Vader. The Emperor asks Vader if he has anything else to discuss. Vader thinks back to the Simoon, to the young farm boy who had witnessed him kill Obi-Wan Kenobi. Vader is troubled. Why had his old master given his old lightsaber to the boy? Vader decides not to tell his master. And so we return to the present. What was Vader's personal request to Jabba the Hutt? Vader has requested the help of Jabba's best bounty hunters. They are a Wookiee named Black Chrysanthemum and a Mandalorian named Boba Fett. Fett's mission is to find Luke Skywalker and bring him back alive, and Chrysanthemum's to find out the identity of the agent working for the Emperor. When focused and working on his missions, Vader is thorough, logical, and committed. Behind the scenes, Vader is troubled, paranoid, and alone. Although he is calm in his meeting with Chrysanthemum and Boba Fett, the final double-page image is Vader standing over a burning encampment of slaughtered sand people. Vader, as once before in his own past, unmoved by his actions. I can't begin to say how good this comic book is. They have been exceptionally clever in developing the aspects of Vader that are not explored in the films, the stuff when he's not working, and it refreshes the character. It gives him a depth and a vulnerability. We can be sickened by the carnage this version of Vader still clings to from his original fall from grace, but we also feel deeply sorry for his troubled soul. The Star Wars title is fun and action-packed, but Darth Vader is a new direction. Salvador LaRocca's artwork is sensational because you barely notice it. Not in a bad way, but it's so natural and full of familiar architecture and stunning close-ups and angles used just at the right points. We have plenty of room for speculation in this series because of the window Marvel have decided to exploit. Darth Vader has to grow from this point. He's at his lowest. The Emperor making him carry the blame for the destruction of the Death Star. He has to take orders from another Imperial officer. Yet by the Empire Strikes Back, he's in charge of the Imperial fleet. What will he do to grow to this rank? Who's the mysterious agent? Perhaps a potential new Sith apprentice to replace Vader. This is a great comic, and I cannot wait to read the next one.
Okay, Marvel Star Wars number 2. Let's do this thing. Actually, before I start, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to Andy and John for their awesome segment that they did on the last episode about Star Wars and Marvel. They brought up some really good points, and I thought it was a very thought-provoking conversation. So if you haven't checked that out, check out their conversation from the last episode. Okay, so back to the review. This is the second issue. So it's book 1, part 2, Skywalker Strikes. The writer is Jason Aaron, the artist is John Castay, colorist is Lara Martin. So the second issue came with a lot less fanfare than issue number 1, which is understandable. You know, it had less variants and a more basic intro. It didn't have the A Long Time Ago in a Galaxy Far, Far Away and the Star Wars logo. This one, it just had the scrolling text, kind of with the summary where the last one left off. And then it just jumps right into the story. Basically, they're still on Simoon 1, where the Empire's largest weapon factory is, and the rebels have freed the slaves who were being held there to run the factory, and their escape is made more difficult when Darth Vader arrives. So, with the last issue, we were left with the cliffhanger of Ben telling Luke to run as he's confronting Vader, but we see in this issue that Luke doesn't listen, and so it starts with Darth Vader, he's kind of chiding Luke and telling him he holds his lightsaber like a child, and he's asking him who he is, and Luke tells him that you killed my father, and then Darth Vader says kind of snarkily, well, I've killed many fathers, you're going to have to be more specific, and so that just really angers Luke to attack Vader, but then when he does that, Darth Vader easily knocks Luke down, and then Vader finds out that Obi-Wan trained Luke, and he uses the Force to take his lightsaber, and then he realizes that he recognizes that lightsaber, but he still doesn't know Luke's identity at this point. So then, meanwhile, the AT-AT is being driven by Han. It comes crashing into where Luke and Vader were, and so everything is kind of in chaos. And the rebels and the slaves' victory is cut short when Vader begins slaughtering some of the slaves. Then Luke, he's kind of wondering what he can do. He's feeling bad for himself. He's just a farm boy. But then he puts his farm boy skills to good use by jumping on a speeder, and he takes out some troopers. And then it's R2-D2 that saves the day once again by activating the cannons on the AT-AT, which enables them to attack Vader and escape. Oh, by the way, spoilers. So, like the last issue, this one also has a lot of nods to the previous films, so I just wanted to name a few of them. We've got Luke yelling, no, in this. Darth Vader, he's holding two lightsabers in the same position that Anakin held them in Revenge of the Sith when he beheads Count Dooku. We've got Sassy Leia when Han is trying to drive the AT-AT and he's smashing things, and Leia tells him to step on Vader, he's the one in black. And I thought that was really funny. I could see Leia just saying that. So 3PO's got some good moments. He brings up the Bocce language. He gets blasted to pieces in this one. Oh, he says, if you'll not be needing me, I'll close down for a while. And Luke brings up Womp Rats. Han's still not a believer in the Force, even though there's clear evidence right in front of him. And then again, you know, like I mentioned on the last review about the slaves. In this one, it made me sad to think about Anakin's past, how he actually was a slave when he was a little boy. And then in this one, he's brutally slaying them. What a sad circumstance. And then also, Han and Leia, they're still bickering. My favorite part in this is when Leia tells R2-D2 that she could kiss him after he activates the cannons. And then Han says, him you want to kiss? I thought that was really funny. So I thought this was another really solid issue. Aaron and Cassidy, they really have a gift for the writing and the art. And the feel of this is just Star Wars all the way. And I'm really liking this era between A New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back. I think it's cool to find out the adventures that happened between these movies because obviously, you know, like it wasn't just nothing happening during them. There was stuff going on and it's cool just to be able to find some of that stuff out. I was a little bit surprised by the violence in this and particularly the part where Darth Vader uses the Force to send the lightsaber right through the Mon Calamari slave's abdomen. That was a little more graphic than I expected, but I mean, I guess it's not any worse than what we've seen in the movies before, but still, I just wasn't expecting that in this. But overall, I felt like this is another really good action-packed series, and it's Star Wars through and through, so I give this one a solid 8 lightsabers out of 10. So I'm really enjoying these Marvel series. I am waiting to get my Darth Vader number one in the mail, and I can't wait to hear Andy's review about that and the upcoming Princess Leia ones as well. So, really exciting. Issue number 3 comes out in March, and I should have a review for that coming up. Alright, I'll catch you on the flip side. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
Okay, one of the nice things we get to do here on Who Wars is interact with people who listen to us pretty easily over social media. Twitter is the big one. We have 1,700 or 1,800 followers there. But Facebook has been really taking off of late. I think we're just a shade under 300 followers there. And one of those Facebook followers is Baz Hood. And Baz posted a couple of questions to us via Facebook. And as I promised Baz, we'd get to them in this episode. I've thrown the questions out there to the team, and we've had some of the team come back with answers. His questions are, firstly, which old or classic foe, which hasn't been revisited since 2005, would you like to see brought back? And for Baz, he says it's kind of kooky, but he'd like to see the Sensorites or the Monoids in the show. They're, of course, some First Doctor foes. And his second question is, who would you love to write or direct an episode of Who? For Baz, he'd like to see Terrence Dix, particularly seeing a Terrence Dix script get, you know, the full million-pound treatment of all the effects and things that, you know, formerly Terrence Dix scripts, I guess, didn't get back in the day. And for director, he'd like to see Peter Jackson. And, you know, on that count, I think Baz will probably get his wish. We've reported here before that Peter Jackson is closer than ever before to directing an episode of Doctor Who. He is a mega Doctor Who fan. He'd probably do it for free. Or I think he said once he'd do it if they gave him a Dalek prop or something, you know, because, hey, Peter doesn't need the money. He'd be really keen to do it, you know. I think they'd be crazy not to give it to him for the cost of a Dalek prop. So, look, thank you, Baz, for those questions. Let's turn it over to the team members and myself. I'll jump in with a few answers as well, I think, and see what people think. First up, which old classic foe, which hasn't been revisited post-2005, would you like to see brought back?
Hey, Baz, thanks for the questions. The Doctor Who monster I would bring back, without a doubt, is the Raston Warrior robot, as featured in The Five Doctors. The concept itself is clever and underused, and in the context of the modern series, it could be realised fantastically. It moves at the speed of light, it can see off a squad of Cybermen with effortless elegance, a sleek, silver, androgynous killing machine. Like a Terminator, you could put this up against any foe, and they would struggle to survive. And it would be great to see in the credits of New Who the words, Raston Warrior Robots, created by Terrence Dix.
Which classic foe would I want to see again? Cool question. I totally agree with the Sensorites and the Monoids. Sensorites in particular, I loved the way they hopped around. They were like big, giant alien bunnies, but genetically crossed with a nude. Good stuff. No, but I mean, they'd be great because they were such a diverse and intellectual species. They obviously had some corruption issues, but yeah, that'd be cool to see them again. I think there'd be a lot to work with there. I think it would be especially great, too, because current viewers are so familiar with the Ood, and they're practically the same, Sensorites and the Ood. So yeah, I think if the Sensorites were to come back, it would affect viewers in a much more personal way. They would be convincing foes, I think, was what I'm trying to say. I'm going on, though, and I think you want me to give a more personalized answer, so I'll go with the current classic Doctor Who episode that I'm watching right now, Fury from the Deep. There are these creatures of seaweed that took over this plant that processes gas. They came up through this pipeline of gas that traveled up from the beach. So this intelligent seaweed is able to telepathically control people because it's a brain parasite. Don't really know or understand how that works entirely, but that's the scenario, and pretty scary if you ask me. I already have enough problems when I'm swimming in the ocean, being scared by seaweed. Anything that touches my leg underwater is pretty scary. So I can imagine that if they were to bring back this foe, it would be terrifying. In fact, it might be as terrifying as Weeping Angels. It'll affect people in such a way that no one will be able to go to the beaches anymore for decades to come. Oh god, what have I suggested? I changed my mind. I hope this never actually happens. I actually like going to the beach, so Doctor Who writers out there, don't actually take this seriously. But my final answer is the seaweed creatures from Fury from the Deep.
Okay, as for me, I guess there's tons of old foes that could be brought back into Doctor Who, and I guess the production team doesn't like to do it too often. They want to move forward, but also give a little nod to the past, so that's why we've had Daleks and Cybermen and, I guess, Ice Warriors and, you know, things of that ilk come back so far. I think what I'd like to see are vampires, and vampires done right. I mean, we had the Vampires of Venice, but they turned out to be these silly fish creatures, and in The Curse of Fenric, the Sylvester McCoy story, they were sort of vampires, but they called them hemivores, and they weren't quite right. You go back, though, to something like State of Decay, and you have the Doctor talking about, you know, being told as a kid about these great wars between the Time Lords and the great vampires, and these bow ships that would fire huge missiles or arrows at these great vampires to kill them. And you think, maybe there's a story to tell there. So, in general, I'd like to see a good vampire story on Doctor Who. I thought we were going to get it with Vampires of Venice until that big reveal that they were just bloody fish. But yeah, there's room for that, I think. And I think a lot of people like vampire stories. I mean, you know, put aside your feelings about, you know, Twilight and ridiculous vampires like that and think more traditional vampires. There's a good, scary, fun story in there somewhere. That's what I'd like to bring back.
I think if I was to look at a bad guy from Doctor Who, I probably would want in from the classic series specifically. I'd look at the second Doctor's serials and look specifically at the newly rediscovered and completed Enemy of the World. I think Ramon Salamander would make an excellent problem for the Doctor. It'd be very interesting to see the Patrick Troughton character come back and be a thorn in his side as a non-alien human who just happens to be pretty good at what he does. And more importantly, he happened to be chucked into the time vortex at the end of the serial, so he could easily come back, as we found with Doctor Who. Death is not really death sometimes, and that particular out works really well in this case. I think the other interesting factor in here is you could also bring in his son, David Troughton, who also happens to act and was actually in the last Christmas episode of Doctor Who. I think he would make a great salamander. You could say, you know, the time vortex changed him slightly or changed him a little, but I think he would work excellent in that role. So I think you have a great possible idea.
We've got some great listener questions this week, so thank you, Baz Hood, for these excellent questions. The first question, which old classic foe would you like to see brought back to Doctor Who? Well, unfortunately, since I don't have that much knowledge about classic Doctor Who, and the only classic Who episodes I've seen up to this point featured the Daleks, I honestly don't even have a good answer for this question. So, sorry about that. I'm going to have to just probably go on to the next question. So, the next one, who would you love to write, direct an episode of Doctor Who? I like what Baz said about Peter Jackson and Hitchcock, of course. Both of those would be really awesome. But I think since this is a Star Wars Doctor Who podcast, why don't we throw George Lucas's name in there? It appears he kind of wants to step away from Star Wars anyway. I still love George Lucas, and I feel like he's a genius in his genre, and I would love to see what he could do with an episode of Doctor Who.
Okay, so here we are into the second question from Baz. Who would you like to write or direct an episode of Who? I see Kate's taken the initiative and already kicked us off here. I'll jump in at this point and say, you know, it's kind of crazy, but I'd like to see a Wes Anderson kind of Doctor Who. I think Wes Anderson is a director with a very distinct style. You know, when you watch a lot of movies, you think, oh yeah, anyone could have really directed this. But when you watch a Wes Anderson film, you go, oh, this is a Wes Anderson film. It could be really interesting to see Doctor Who done in a quirky Wes Anderson kind of way. It would have to be a special of some kind, or maybe a short. I don't think it could actually sit comfortably in the middle of a series with, you know, more regular sort of episodes around it. But yeah, if Wes Anderson could be involved in some way, that'd be my vote.
If I could bring a classic writer back, it would be Ben Aronovitch, because his Rivers of London books are fantastic. But for a new writer, I'd like to suggest Mitch Benn, the comedian and musician. Mitch appears every Friday on BBC Radio 4 on The Now Show, performing clever and satirical songs about the week's news. He's also written two amazing sci-fi books called Terror and Terror's World, which are a love letter to Douglas Adams and Neil Gaiman without trying to hide it, and he puts in so many archetypal sci-fi elements that you feel you are already a part of the new and clever stories he weaves. You can just get on and enjoy the adventure. At the heart of the books are a strong understanding of family. This also comes through in Mitch's tweets when he talks about his own family. So humour, good sci-fi and family, perfect ingredients for Doctor Who, which he's also a huge fan of. Director, easy again, Baz Luhrmann, and please doing an historical. He creates the mood of an era whilst keeping it modern and fantastical, creating amazing colours and angles and layers. I'm aware Baz is doing a series for Netflix, so fingers crossed.
Now, if I was to look at directors, I think the director I'd probably bring in would be Joss Whedon. I think the reason why I would take Joss is simply because he has experience making television productions, especially in sci-fi. He did Buffy the Vampire Slayer, of course, and he also did Firefly, which is fairly well acclaimed by sci-fi fans. So he understands the genre, he understands how to get the most out of it, and of course his success with the Avengers obviously gives him even more reason to be used. I think from a standpoint of Doctor Who, I think he could bring in something that would be a little interesting and as an American director would have a different point of view than some of his British counterparts. However, of course, there is one knock against him. He actually called the classic series, at least some parts of it, cheesy at one time in his life, but then again, I think we all would admit that in some ways it is cheesy.
I would want to have J.K. Rowling as a writer for Doctor Who more than anyone else. I know it sounds stupid. She's too big to write for Doctor Who, but I read somewhere on the internet that she may have contributed to the 50th anniversary in some way. The 50th anniversary episode, I mean. And she was interested in writing for Doctor Who. And, you know, everything on the internet is true, so not that crazy. But seriously, I would love for that to happen. I think it would be really cool. She's got such a brilliant mind, and her writing is fantastic. And, you know, how many Harry Potter characters actors of the Harry Potter characters have been on Doctor Who? Tons! I think I could throw out a number like, I don't know, 12, maybe 14, that many actors. I don't think I'd be too far off. It's been a lot. I'm too lazy to look it up. But yeah, she's practically written for the characters already, the type of character that would be on Doctor Who. So, valid point in case, and that's my one and only answer.
Alrighty, that wraps up the questions from Baz Hood, and you know, if you're sitting out there and you've got questions you'd like to hear myself, or Kate, or Lex, or Jonathan, or Alan, who didn't contribute here, obviously he's not a Doctor Who fan, he's more on the Star Wars side of things, or Andy, you know, if you'd like to hear answers from any of us, throw us some questions. Throw them up on Twitter, throw them up on Facebook. You've obviously got more text to work with on Facebook. Email them to us, whatever you like, and we'd love to throw them into the show. I have it on good authority that Steele Saunders from Steel Wars might be throwing us a Star Wars question very soon, hopefully by the next episode. I think that could be very interesting. But whether you're Steele Saunders or not, please throw us some questions. We love doing this kind of thing. Hope you enjoyed listening to it.
And so we come to the final instalment of The Swords of Kali. But as you may guess from my previous reviews of this story, I've not been too impressed with it. A little down to a bit of a higgledy-piggledy plot, but mostly because of inconsistent and, to be fair, substandard artwork. Although, as I explained in my first review, not to the fault of illustrator Dave Taylor.
Mumbai, India, 2315.
In an attempt to save Clara from the evil Skindia, a shape-shifting dynasty dedicated to reviving the ancient goddess Kali, the Doctor has reluctantly agreed to find Kali's final sword, which will grant the restored alien benefactor ultimate power. The Doctor is joined by Rani, a warrior from the 1820s, on a mission of revenge against the Skindia's Fuggy cult for killing her beloved. Meanwhile, thousands of citizens have moved to Haven, a perfect new orbital space city where something sinister is afoot. And Clara, also not as safe as the Doctor had hoped, having just become the host body for Kali's resurrection. Now, it's not that this story isn't good, but there is a lot of material going into it. A lot of threads. Too much too soon in the whole comic book series, perhaps. Sometimes three episodes isn't enough. I felt they should have shuffled the story a bit and gone back to basics with this one. Only in this episode did we really find out about the Skindia's Haven space station. This should have been the setting from the start, like an Ark in Space, Revenge of the Cybermen, Beast Below kind of thing. Make it simple. The timey-wimey would have made good bookends, as we discover in this issue that the Thuggy aliens are time-based life form, and the Swords of Kali will act as conductors to rip open time and space portals all over the universe, giving them ultimate power. The citizens of Mumbai, who think they've headed to a utopian life on Baldhaven, discover they are to have their energy and souls sucked out to feed the Kali. Of course, everything works out fine. The Doctor reverses the polarity to use the souls against the Kali and rescue the impossible girl. Priyanka, remember her? She's the daughter of Tiger Maratha, who started the whole ball rolling on this adventure. Now, having studied the plans for the Haven space station at uni, she uses an unforeseen design flaw to destroy it and the monsters. Sound familiar? We finally get the crowded street scenes a few issues too late that would have given the story more context, and Priyanka and Rani, free of their pasts and the monsters, fall in love. Aww. Now, I must admit, Priyanka and Rani are absolutely fantastic characters and would be brilliant to come back in any of the 12 Doctor stories, I think, and could be really good. References to the Fourth Doctor in issue 1 were not really for any reason, and mentions of the age of the British Empire's rule of India that were also hinted at in the first instalment of this story were also never developed. An opportunity missed for some education. Well, I hope some of you enjoyed the story and got a lot out of it, but in the end, I was let down by the inconsistent colouring line. In this issue, from frame to frame, the Doctor may as well have been in a hall of mirrors he stretched and moulded about so much. For me, this story had all the right elements, but not necessarily in the right order. I'm pretty sure there are a lot more obstacles, writing and editorial problems in creating the further adventures of the 12th Doctor and Clara. For one, the 12th Doctor is still developing on screen as a character, whereas the adventures of the other Doctors have definite bookends. They also have to have their stories more scrutinised by the Doctor Who production office in case there are clashes with what's going to be on the telly. The other obstacle affecting this is the demographic for the 12th Doctor. As he's the current Doctor, he's the one the fresh fans and the kiddies know. Therefore, these scripts are a little more child-friendly than the stories we've certainly seen for the 10th Doctor in his title publication. All I can say is the paint's still wet on this one, and as our friend and comic bookologist John told us the other week when we looked at Star Wars issue 1, you have to give these things time to bed in and have their lifespan, which is why I'm exceptionally excited to move on to the next story, Fractured World, and we can let this title grow and bed in.
Hey everybody, I hope you've been enjoying these fan interviews as much as I've been having fun recording them. So this episode, I've got another one for you. This time I sat down with Anna from New Zealand. She's a major Whovian and Star Wars fan, and she's starting a new blog called Mango Frog. I hope you guys enjoy the interview. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Hi.
Hi, it's good to have you here.
Oh, thanks for the great opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. So we want to start with the time-honored question, Star Wars or Doctor Who? Which one would you pick?
Can I say both?
Sure, absolutely.
Even though I'm kind of obsessed with the Doctor at the moment, I still really enjoy Star Wars. Yeah, last year was actually the first time I'd seen all the movies all the way through, so...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Cool. Starter, but yeah.
Yeah, you can definitely pick both, and you're at the right place. You're at a Star Wars Doctor Who podcast, so...
Yeah.
Since you picked both, let's just talk about Star Wars for a little bit first. Yep. So, yep. Like, who's your favorite character?
I'll probably say R2-D2.
Oh, nice. R2's my favorite, too. I love R2-D2.
Yeah, I just love the fact he's just so courageous and fun and just goes about helping people while C-3PO's a bit out up there and scared of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's like the real hero of the movie, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Have you seen the teaser trailer for the new movie, the episode 7 coming out?
Yeah, I've seen the teaser. I haven't read anything else about it, really, because I just don't want to spoil anything for my...
Oh, gotcha.
When I go see it. But yeah, I'm definitely keen to see it and see what kind of storyline they have for these new ones.
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Do you like the little droid in that one? He's called BB-8. He's like the little soccer ball thing.
Yeah, that's quite cool.
I love him. He's so cute. Is there anything like in particular that you'd like to see in episode 7?
Not particularly. No, I'm just keen to see what for these ones.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. So you said you watched all the movies before that. Which one is your favorite of all the ones that you watched?
Oh, God, it's tough.
I know, it's hard to pick.
Yeah, I can't actually narrow it down to just one.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You're allowed to have more than one favorite.
Yeah.
How about the new show Rebels? Have you watched that at all?
I've watched a few episodes of that. Yeah,
oh,
that's
cool.
So,
yeah, it's pretty interesting. Did you watch Clone Wars at all?
No, I hadn't actually seen any of that.
Oh, okay. Clone Wars is really good. It got better as it went along, and I kind of feel like that's where Rebels is at right now. Like,
yeah.
Like, it's pretty good, but I think it's going to get a lot better.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but yeah, I like Chopper on that show too. He's funny.
Yeah, he's a little cool thing.
Yeah, they do good with the droids.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to Doctor Who. I know that you like Doctor Who, because that's what your blog is based on, I guess we could talk about that now. Do you want to tell us about your blog? Like, tell us what the title is and, like, what you intend to do with it.
The title is very, very random. I just chose something that didn't kind of limit me to just Doctor Who in case I wanted to expand it later on. Yeah, I just thought that this year's kind of be my year of the Doctor, so to say. And I'm going to watch all the Doctor Who's, and I'm going to the Doctor Who Symphony Spectacular in
very
a couple
of weeks.
And there's also rumour about a Doctor Who convention in New Zealand this year, so crossing my fingers that it's
true.
That
would be awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So it's called Mango Frog.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. I like that. That's really cool.
Yeah,
I just mangoes and I like frogs. So
yeah, same. I just thought I'd share my experiences and thoughts, and hopefully people enjoy it and come along with the journey with me and see how it goes.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I understand there's also a Dalek toy on the line.
Yeah, that was just a random thought I had the other day. Instead of just going out and buying it, I thought, why not just make it a bit of a challenge for me?
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Well, hopefully when people hear this, they'll go and follow your blog and you can get closer to getting your Dalek.
Hopefully, yeah.
That would be awesome. Okay, so let's talk a little bit of Doctor Who then. So, basic stuff. Who's your favorite Doctor?
I would have to be Matt Smith so far.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I haven't seen too much of the other ones, like Eccleston or all the other ones yet. But Matt Smith is definitely very exuberant, and he's like a hyperactive monkey sometimes.
Yeah. That's funny.
I just like the energy he brings to it, and
yeah, he's a very cool. He's very entertaining.
Yeah.
All right, so how about your favorite companion?
That would probably be Rose Tyler.
Oh, nice. I like Rose, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, is there any particular reason why?
I just like the fact that she started off just as a regular person.
Yeah, I like that, too.
Kind of rescuing from her life, and then she just goes off and has all these cool adventures and actually ends up helping the Doctor as well. So.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, Rose is pretty awesome. So how about, who's your favorite villain?
The scariest ones would probably have to be a tie between the Weeping Angels and the Silence.
Oh, yeah, those are good ones. What would happen if a Weeping Angel saw a Silence? That would be an interesting showdown.
Oh, that would... How long that would take.
I know. I wonder if they'll
stare at each other.
Yeah, I know. That would be an interesting episode, huh?
It would. They should do that, definitely.
I know. Is there somewhere we can email suggestions or something?
They should.
I know, right? If you could time travel to any era, what era do you think you'd like to go to?
I'd like to go to the dinosaur era just to see if what...
Ooh, yeah.
They look like is actually true.
That would be cool.
Yeah. If they have feathers or scales or...
Yeah.
And actually eat each other or...
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
So this is a little off topic, but are you a Jurassic Park fan?
I am actually, yeah.
Awesome. Are you excited for Jurassic World coming out?
Yeah, I've seen pictures of what's happening and...
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
I'm excited. Next to Star Wars coming out, I think that's the most excited I'm about is that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay, so back to the Who Wars. I asked an interesting question on the podcast a few episodes ago to the team about what actor you'd like to see play the Doctor. So how about you?
That's an interesting one.
I know.
Tried to think about all these British actors.
I know.
The one that came to mind was that if they want a younger Doctor, maybe the actor from Ender's Game.
I haven't seen that yet.
I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
But he's a lot younger, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Hmm. I can't remember his name, but yeah, just if I wanted an younger Doctor.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Sweet. So, what did you think of Series 8?
We haven't actually seen too much of Series 8 over here.
Oh.
I haven't, anyway.
Oh, I don't want to spoil anything for you.
I've seen maybe a few of them, but not... Okay.
Do you like Capaldi as the Doctor?
Yeah, I do, actually. I wasn't entirely sure at the start.
Uh-huh.
Maybe he'd be a bit too stiff and old. But
yeah.
Yeah, he actually brings it off quite well.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like him. He's kind of, like, grumpy and stuff, but I think that's pretty funny.
Yeah, just like the grumpy granddad.
Yeah. I think maybe he... Well, did you watch the Christmas episode?
Yeah, I saw that one.
So he kind of seems like he's softening maybe a little bit, so it'll be interesting to see what the next series is like. Okay, so how about episodes? Do you have a favorite episode or episodes?
My favorite one would probably be Asylum of the Daleks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was probably the most epic Dalek one I've seen so far, as well as the introduction of Clara to the...
Yeah, that was the one with the souffle girl, right?
Souffle girl, yeah.
Yeah, that one's good. I'm in the middle of, like, rewatching the new Doctor Who stuff. I think I'm in the Matt Smith era with Amy and Rory, but I'm getting to pretty soon where I'll be seeing Clara and stuff, so that'll be interesting. So have you watched much of Classic Who?
No, not really. That's what I want to get into this year.
Yeah. I know, I haven't watched. I've only seen, like, a couple episodes of it.
Yeah.
You should watch more of it.
I saw the BBC documentary, the 50th anniversary one, where they showed the progression of all the doctors. And, the early ones look quite interesting.
Yeah. For sure. I know, I just have such a short attention span. Those episodes, they tend to, like, really drag on.
Yeah.
I have to, like, really focus. I have to be in a very focused mood to watch them. I'm like, do you have anything else that you want to say about your blog?
I just really hope that everyone really likes it.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's only been going for like 3 weeks and already on a podcast, so
yay.
That's pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've also got a lot more followers on Twitter.
Yeah, that's cool.
Like 90% of them are Doctor Who fans at the moment.
It's a really great fan community, the Doctor Who. So have you ever done, like, any cosplay or anything like that with Doctor Who?
No, I haven't got into that sort of stuff yet.
Okay. That's
hopefully
cool.
Hopefully if there's a convention this year, I'll do something about that.
That would be cool. I might do Matt Smith, like a female Matt Smith cosplay.
That'd be cool.
Because I actually have, like, this tweed jacket. It's like, that is, like, so Matt Smith. And then you just need to add, like, a bow tie.
And
but I might actually switch it up and do the cowboy hat.
Okay, yeah, that's cool, too. Yeah.
But, yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. Got it, Doctor Who Monster Marathon on BBC UK this afternoon. So.
Oh, nice. So you got plans, huh?
And luckily it's a rainy day here, so I don't feel so bad.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. It's a rainy day here, too. How funny is that? Okay, so do you want to tell people how they can get a hold of you, like your web address and your Twitter handle?
They've both got the same name, really. My Twitter is MangoFrog. And my blog address is just mangofrog.wordpress.com.
Okay, so Anna, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for the great opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. All right, thanks, Anna. That was a lot of fun doing that interview. And be sure to follow Anna's blog, Mango Frog, for more Doctor Who updates and a chance to win a Dalek toy.
Exterminate!
Alright, and here we are at the end of the 24th Who Wars. All that's left for me to say is thank you so very much to the team for your features and for your reviews and for everything you do for the show. A warm hello again to John and Alan coming on board this time around with your Star Wars Rebels material. I'm really looking forward to where you take it in the weeks and months ahead, especially when Rebels goes off the air for a while. That'll be interesting, but I digress. If you're sitting out there and wondering how you can help the show, the simplest way is to pot it forward. If you know someone who likes Star Wars and Doctor Who, why not tell them about the show? I'm sure there are people out there who have no clue we exist who might really like our shtick, you know, really like what we're doing. Also, if you're an iTunes user, if you can jump on iTunes and leave us a rating and review, it does help other people find us. And you know what? I say that a lot on the show, but after recording this, I'm going to take my own advice. I'm going to jump on iTunes and leave some ratings and reviews for shows that I like, shows that I've plugged many times here on Who Wars, actually, but I've never left a rating and review for. So if you have a show out there and you do listen to Who Wars and you do see a review from me, that's what it's all about. If you could leave the same for us, that would be great. Even if you don't have a podcast that I've left a rating and review for, if you have iTunes, please jump on, leave us a rating and review, let other people know about us, let Who Wars go out there and propagate amongst the nerds and geeks of the universe. That would be awesome. Ways to get in touch with us are in the closing credits. Listen to the fantastic disco music. The lady will tell you what to do. That's all I've got. I'll see you in a fortnight's time. Until then, I remain Rob Irwin. Take care of yourselves, and we'll see you next time.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.